Okay, so I want to continue with these three areas of reflection around embodiment. The first being what it is, what it means to inhabit the body fully, to be an embodied human being. The second, the embodiment of the attitudes, the intentions that transform our hearts and lives. And the third, the embodiment of understanding. Now this first one, the inhabiting of the body, mindfulness of the body, to live as an embodied human being. I have a friend I teach with who's come up with this wonderful kind of metaphor. Is everybody in this room familiar with the Satipatthana discourse, the ways of establishing mindfulness, the four ways of establishing mindfulness? In the body, in feeling tone, in moods, and in cognitive domains, okay? This is the primary discourse, of course, that underlies most insight meditative traditions. So a friend of mine has used this metaphor of four channels. You know, if you think about, we've got four channels that are always on air. They're always broadcasting. Okay, the first of those channels is the body. The second of those channels is Vedana, or feeling. The third of those channels is moods, or mental states. And the fourth of those channels is the cognitive realm of experience. Now, we choose about what channel we switch on to. Doesn't mean the others stop broadcasting, like any TV. But they're not what we're watching. So what channel do you spend most of your time on? For most people, it's the cognitive domain. It's like there's this cutoff point, you know, this dividing line, you know, the Berlin Wall between our head and the rest of our felt, lived experience. So what did the Buddha do with this? You see how much attention is given to embodying the body, to inhabiting the body, to establishing mindfulness within the body. But not just in some sort of passive observation of the body, but to inhabit the body with mindfulness and insight. Mindfulness and insight. So I think culturally and spiritually there hasn't always been an encouragement to do this, and not only, as I mentioned earlier, how much still today, you know, the body is so much reviled in a number of Buddhist traditions as being a source of attachment and a source of clinging, you know, that you're better out of it. You know, you're better out of it than in it. Now, this message sadly kind of matches up to many of our cultural traditions. And I think there are a lot of reasons, very valid reasons, why people feel it difficult to inhabit their body. If there's pain or illness, this does not feel like a welcoming place to be. If there's trauma kind of stored within the body, memory, you know, somatic memory of emotional trauma, this is not a place that it feels safe to be. And so the tendency to dissociate, it's a strange tension, isn't it? Because so often in times of pain or discomfort, the body is shouting at us, pay attention. And the mind is shouting at us, don't. Don't go there. And so it is very easy to foster tendencies to dissociate, to disconnect from the body, or to feel aversion. There is also no doubt that even though we don't necessarily inhabit the body very fully much of our life, it is certainly our primary building block of self. It is the aggregate that is the primary building block of self. And we may not feel that to be such an up experience in your life until you get ill, or until there's some injury, or until there's some pain, and then you see that surge of my body, when my body is me, arising so quickly. We are also, of course, encouraged in our culture to have these very strange relationships with the body, the preoccupation with appearance, with how we look, you know, being some measure of who we are. Or we're encouraged really just to kind of neglect it or feel indifferent towards it, as if this is some kind of taxi cab, you know, we're getting around in, until it shouts at us to pay attention. And I'm sure many of you are familiar with the lines from that novel that Mr. Duffy lived a short distance from his body. And there we are on Channel 4, you know, living either a short distance or quite a big distance from our body until we feel forced in sometimes to pay attention. So within the relationship to the body, this is our primary place where we begin to form patterns of disconnection and dissociation. This is our primary place where we begin to learn lessons of disembodiment. And it's useful to be aware of that. As we sit here right now, are we aware of the sensations in our body? When we speak, are we aware of listening to the body as we speak? As we listen, are we listening from within the body or filtering through Channel 4? Now, pretty much all mindfulness practice and all practices of insight meditation are rooted in mindfulness of the body. The Buddha once actually said that if there is no mindfulness of the body, there is no mindfulness at all. It's quite a big statement. And if there's no mindfulness of the body, there is no mindfulness at all. And certainly in the Satipatthana, it's very obvious that the very largest section of this teaching of insight and this teaching of waking up, the very largest section is on the body. In secular mindfulness teachings, you know, contemporary mindfulness-based applications, they primarily form their roots within mindfulness of the body. And it's a good question to ask, you know, why did the Buddha give this such emphasis? So, why? The separation, I think, between mind, heart, and body is inevitably a separation from this present moment. That when we're dissociated from the body, we're very rarely inhabiting this life very fully. And what causes that disconnection? I think it's really interesting to look at what leads us to be switching from channel 1 into channel 3 or channel 4 so often. Sometimes it's the power of channel 3 and 4. You know, the power of our moods, the power of our impulses, the attraction of our ruminations, our obsessions, our planning, the power of the emotional and psychological impulses that simply dominate consciousness. And when that happens, awareness of the body often just simply disappears, doesn't it? You sense that, how the body just fades out of awareness, that we get lost in our mental states. So mindfulness of the body is our somatic experience, is not simply about developing a moment-to-moment awareness of sensation. It is about what is being learnt within the body. And as the Buddha put it, everything that needs to be learnt can be learnt within the length of this body. And as Walt Whitman put it, you know, everything we have ever done, everything we do, and everything we will ever do we will do through this body. Now, there's these different elements of mindfulness which I think are often not talked about so much. And the first of those elements is developing this capacity for a simple knowing. I would really like you to eject the phrase bare attention from your knowledge base. This was a phrase coined by Nyanaponika Thera, who said he regretted it about 10 minutes later. But it's become, you know, sort of part of common coinage. But this simple knowing what is going on. And the second dimension or in this framework of mindfulness is cultivating a protective awareness. And again, I think this is very crucial. Protective awareness is not about defensiveness. It's born of discriminating wisdom about what leads to suffering and what leads to the end of suffering. And what the mind, the heart, is being protected from is the power of being and the overwhelming experience of some of our impulses and habit patterns that do lead to distress. The third dimension of mindfulness of awareness in this framework is sometimes put forward as being introspective awareness. And the simile that is used is like a surgeon's probe. It's the element of mindfulness that's really concerned with investigation. That we actually look into these areas of distress as much as a surgeon would probe a wound to see what was actually going on and to be able to diagnose the cause of the ailment, to be able to deliver a prognosis that there's a possibility of healing and freedom from this ailment, and then to prescribe a course of treatment, which of course is the practice. And the fourth dimension in this framework, it has really not an easy English equivalent, but it is a cognitive reframing. It's a cognitive reframing that our views may not be the truth. And, you know, one of the primary areas of cognitive reframing is that the body is me and that I am the body and that what happens to the body happens to me. So this cognitive reframing, of course, is concerned with loosening this element of identification which causes so much distress. So the teachings of awakening, the teachings of insight, really begin with both the cognitive reframing and the simple knowing. To know the body as the body. To know the body as the body. It sounds simple. It's not quite so easy. But when we do this, and when we really explore this, what becomes clear is the body is always a present moment experience. And what is the primary beginning of any path is establishing a present moment recollection. And the body is always a present moment experience. We do not have yesterday's migraine. We do not have next week's toothache. We have what is being experienced right now. And returning to the body is always returning, exercising and developing that capacity to establish a present moment recollection. And the Buddha was very clear in this in the instructions, you know, whether standing, sitting, walking, lying down, whether coming or going, establishing mindfulness of the body. And we sense the challenge of this and what it is an antidote to, because it is an antidote to habit. It's an antidote to the patterns of disconnection and dissociation. It's an antidote to the habits of being lost in our ruminations about the past or our fantasies and fears about the future. It's an antidote to being lost in our preoccupations of the present. In every moment, there is that returning to being embodied, to inhabiting the body fully. I think we are learning to undo some of the most powerful habit patterns of our lives that lead not only to confusion and fear, but actually lead to disembodiment or dissonance. Does anybody have any questions about that? Disagreements, arguments? Yes. Protective mindfulness. It's a very big part of developing, I think, embodiment. It's a very big part of stepping back from patterns of confusion. Certainly when the Buddha talks about dukkha, when the Buddha talks about the experiences of emotional and psychological suffering, he very much really points out that these are not static states, that these are patterns that create and recreate suffering and struggle, basically through being lost in them, overwhelmed in them, fascinated by them, addicted to them. And so protective awareness involves that capacity built upon knowing, the simple knowing, adding the discerning element about what leads to distress and what leads to the end of distress, and embodying that discernment about knowing what it is helpful to not feed. What is helpful to not feed? How it is helpful to not feed patterns of distress, knowing that they do not have a life of their own, that the life of patterns of distress really relies upon the ways that they're fed through thought, through identification, through aversion, through craving. And what we're learning to protect from are all of the mechanisms that feed into that creation and recreation of distress. And it's really a commitment, in my understanding, to protecting the well-being and the capacity and the potentiality of our own hearts and minds for some of the depth that we touched upon earlier. It's very important to know the difference between protection and defensiveness, because protection is really rooted in that discernment, whereas defensiveness is just more that mechanism that says no. You know, it's an aversion mechanism. Channel 3 is essentially really concerned with our moods, our mental states, the state of our mind, the kind of emotional climate of our mind. And, you know, there's obviously a strong relationship between Channel 3 and Channel 4 because, you know, our mood of the moment is actually going to determine our thought streams of the moment. You know, and our mental state of the moment is going to determine the shape and the flavor of our thoughts of the moment. Channel 3 is basically beginning to bring some of those tools of simple knowing and introspection into that world of our moods, which are not always negative, you know. There are plenty of lovely states of mind around. You know, calmness, spaciousness, kindness, generosity. There's plenty of lovely and there's plenty of afflictive ones. Anger, fear, rage, irritation, vexation. You know, there's plenty of those around.
Yeah.
Channel 4 is much more the cognitive domain. They cross over. Okay. We're all sitting here fully awake and clear. Right, good, thank you. So learning to be present within the body, really learning to inhabit the body, to be embodied, is a way of learning to be present in this interrelated mind-body process, you know. And it is really so artificial, this cut-off line, you know, of the neck. You know, and actually, you know, it's something that even came into our way of thinking through a number of Greek philosophers, you know, that kind of established the primacy of the mind and decided the body just kind of dragged along in some sort of secondary fashion. And it's certainly upheld a lot in our culture, you know, with a lot of esteem for intellect and intellectual process and, you know, not so much esteem for the so-called tackiness of the body. But actually what we learn within mindfulness and within being more embodied is actually this very interrelated mind-body process. Also, please be aware, in Buddhist psychology, we don't make a distinction between mind and heart. So when I use the word mind, you have to think of the word heart also. I could use the word heart, and you have to think of the word mind. But we start to see how very, very transparent is the divide between mind-heart and that very felt somatic experience. Because their mind-body are constantly sending signals to one another and shaping one another. I mean, think about it. If your mind is dull, what does your body do? What kind of messages is your mind sending to your body sending to your mind in that moment? Let's just check out here. What kind of messages is your mind sending to your body? Think about anxiety, the body of anxiety. You know, how thought patterns are constantly sending messages into the body, you know, and this is not particularly Buddhist, this is pretty physiologically traced. You know, the messages anxiety is sending into the body and how those messages take root and reinforce those patterns in the mind. Think about the body of anger, you know, how the thought patterns or the body of anger, and it can go either way, but it's such a closed feedback loop situation. And when it's a closed feedback loop situation, the afflictive becomes increasingly solidified. Okay? So the teaching of mindfulness is begin, you know, because it's very difficult actually to just go into the mind of anxiety or the mind of anger. But we can actually go into the body of anger and the body of anxiety. And we can actually know what that body feels like. And as we do this, actually, we are turning many of these nouns we use or states we imagine into a process language. Sadness is happening, fear is happening, and we see it is process. And we see the difficulties and the pitfalls of turning process into state. Because there's this continuum, we turn process into state, we turn state into personal definition. I am really angry, I am an angry person. It's a very short step, isn't it? What happens in coming into the body, of course, is returning to the actuality of process language, which is beginning to unstick some of that identification which causes so much distress. Mindfulness of the body is more, of course, than just the sensations of the body and the processes of the body. It includes mindfulness of our sense doors, because our sense doors play such a key role in building our world of the moment. Our eyes, our ears, our sense of touch, smell, taste, and of course the sense door of the mind. And we just see how much our sense doors are implicated in our world of the moment, and how much our mind and our emotional states are implicated in how our sense doors are being used. Think of this, you know, if the mind is very discontented, you know, feeling kind of bored, something's missing, how don't the eyes just become so hungry? The ears become so hungry? Think about when the mind's in a state of aversion, or how then are the eyes used to highlight imperfection in the world around us? You know, I love in the kind of description of dependent arising that the Buddha uses to describe how our world is constructed moment to moment, that the image that is used for the sense doors are the five open windows in a house, and the door is the sixth sense door of the mind. And it just portrays how the world of sensory information is constantly coming in through those open windows. All the sights, all the sounds, the smells, taste, touch, and how the world of our views, our patterns, our impulses are moving out through the sense doors. Into the world. And how mindfulness is asking us to stand on that threshold, you know, and to be aware of the power of our sense doors in shaping our world, and to stand on that threshold and to receive that world of sensory impression with mindfulness, with investigation, and to sense inwardly within the body how the body is beginning to react or to respond to that sensory information. Because those open doors of the house and the open windows of the house are also the windows through which we articulate kindness, generosity, compassion, care, empathy, not only the difficult, but also that which is truly liberating. Pause a moment. I feel like I'm at an auction the moment anybody moves their arm. Yes, please.
I'm just struck by the prior question about protective mindfulness, and Thich Nhat Hanh and others talk about guarding the sense doors from the onslaught of what can be an onslaught of quite the nature of our world and the nature of difficulties.
Yes, I mean, the Buddha actually spoke about guarding of the sense doors. It was one of the primary teachings of mindfulness of the body. But it wasn't so much, the way the Buddha talked about it, wasn't so much about guarding the mind from the world of sensory impressions, although, you know, there's a lot of teaching around cultivating simplicity and collectedness. But it actually spoke about guarding the world, protecting the world through the misuse of our sense doors. Which is kind of an interesting reversal. That it's not, you know, certainly there's a challenge in learning to simplify how we relate to the onslaught of sensory impression, which is in our hands, but in terms of insight and in terms of being a participant in healing the world, I think there's much more to do with protecting the world from the onslaught of our reactions. Somebody else had their, yeah.
So for instance, you just following on that,
Yes, very much so. Very much so. And I will go into this more, but we realize that, you know, the kind of two of those primary threads of constructing suffering, of craving and ill will, are primarily used or employed through the mechanisms of the sense doors. Okay, so as I mentioned, learning to embody the body is quite a big picture. And I think a very large piece of that picture of learning to embody the body as this first dimension of embodiment is, what is being learned? What is being learned within the domain of the body? Because there are lessons that are intended to be learned, that are really meant to transform our hearts and to heal dissonance and particularly discrepancy thinking, this gap between how things are and how we think they should be, this gap between how I am and how I think I should be, and also obviously this quite large gap between how you are and how I think you should be. So discrepancy thinking is a big one. It's an ocean of tears. It's certainly the cause of much of our obsessions, much of our ruminations, much of our strategizing to fix it. It can be a very big feature of Channel 4. You know, we can spend a lot of time in that area. And actually, you know, when we hear this statement to align ourselves with the way things actually are, which is used so much in the Buddhist teaching, please don't hear that as some sort of invitation to passivity or a statement of ideology. You know, when the Buddha speaks about aligning ourselves with the way things actually are, he's talking about the three characteristics. Aligning ourselves with the actuality of impermanence, aligning ourselves with the actuality of non-self, and aligning ourselves with the actuality of dukkha and understanding dukkha. Because it's that, this is our biggest area of discrepancy thinking, you know, and dissonance and disconnection. Is our lives are not aligned with the three characteristics. So this I will go into much later. Well, some of it I'll go into later, some of it I'll go into right now. So learning to contemplate the body as the body is the doorway to understanding the first ennobling truth. This characteristic, this universal reality that is central in all of our lives of dukkha. Everybody familiar with that word? Okay, I will go into it because the understanding of dukkha sets the ground for the whole development of the Buddha's pathway of understanding. It's like that introspective awareness I was talking about it, where you look at the wound and you look at the cause of the wound. But dukkha, I think, has become, you know, terribly simplified in the Dharma. I mean, it's usually translated as suffering, which is really quite a limited translation, I must say, and actually not very accurate. And so I think it is deeply important to understand dukkha correctly. So for those of you who have more experience in the practice, forgive me for belaboring this. But the first domain of dukkha is simply dukkha-dukkha. It is the pain of pain. It is concerned with, you know, the pain of a broken leg. It's the pain of pain. You know, it's the pain of an illness. It's the pain of pain. You know, it's the aching back. It's just the pain of pain. It's the pain of our mortality. And the fragility of a human body is the pain of pain. You know, we do see, and this is one of our primary lessons that we learn within the body, is to embrace all of this, that we are born and that our lives are going to follow a certain trajectory towards our death. And in between those two points, we are all going to have our own measure of frailty, of illness, of loss, and unwelcome change. And this is one of the places where we get into a lot of discrepancy thinking and a lot of dissonance. This certainly shouldn't be happening. You know, this certainly shouldn't be happening. I cannot tell you how, you know, and I see it in our own minds, you know, teaching, and somebody says, well, if something happens to my partner, when something happens to my partner, if I die, when I die, if I get ill, when I get ill. We know this, you know, we know this level of dukkha. I mean, it's really hard to ignore, isn't it? Just look in the mirror, you know. I mean, we know this, we see it written in all the bodies around us, those we love, those we struggle with, and the many we don't know. And it's certainly one of our primary areas of dissonance and dissociation. And you know, it's so interesting in the Buddha's teaching around confusion and ignorance. You know, it's just two parts of confusion and ignorance. One is not knowing, and the other is not wanting to know. I don't want to know this. I know it, but I don't want to know it. To know it and pretend that this is not so. To pretend that it's not so, to live in a way as if one day we're not going to be that person in wheelchair who no longer thinks clearly, who loses their independence, who's ill, who may lose their mobility, and who will die. It's a simple truth that inhabiting the body with mindfulness and with insight guides us to learn this, and yet it's a lesson we resist with great ferocity. And sometimes I think it's a very interesting question to look in our own lives, you know, when there's distress. And, you know, how much do we put down to confusion, to not knowing what's going on, and how much do we put down to not wanting to know? Good, not wanting to know, that's not a peaceful state, by the way. You know, it takes a lot of energy not wanting to know. It takes a lot of pretending. It takes a lot of energy. You know, we have to do so much strategizing to not wanting to know. You know, we can do it collectively and we can do it individually. You know, it's like in Stephen Levine leading one of his workshops on death and dying, and started with asking the question, who in this room is going to die? And it took a really long time for anybody to raise their hand. Looking at, it's got to be somebody in here. Now, it's interesting, this one, because I think when people read this section on the Satipatthana, on establishing mindfulness of the body, it's so countercultural and it's so counterintuitive. You know, I remember when we bought Gaia House and we inherited a cemetery with the center. You know, Stephen Batchelor and I were walking around with grins all over our face, you know, thinking, fantastic, you know, we finally got the cemetery, you know. Because what are the Buddha's contemplations, you know, cemetery contemplations, take apart the body, think about your body, think about what it looked like to wear your insides on the outsides. Think about that, what that would do with body obsession, you know, and a fascination with appearance, you know. Actually inhabit the body as it is, not putting all the labels on it, of that's morbid, or that's lovely, or that's ugly, or that's beautiful. This is what we do. And the Buddha talks about contemplating the body with ardency and diligence. Whether standing or sitting or walking or lying down, to cultivate this quality of appamatta, to never be divorced, to never lose sight of where the body is in this moment. Because we learn much about our lives through the life of our body. We certainly learn a lot about impermanence. You know, and it's not surprising, you know, when the Buddha lists the three great liberating insights into change, dukkha, and anatta, that he puts impermanence first. You know, and he said, just like, you know, in the jungle, the elephant's footprint is the greatest of all the animals' footprints, so the insight into impermanence and change is actually the most liberating of all of the insights. We have very mixed relationships to the body. We're okay with it when it's doing well. But we can easily blame ourselves for illness or for frailty, fearing the disintegration of the body, fearing pain, strategizing and hoping for a different future. We say this shouldn't be happening, but you know, we could be the most mindful person in the world, eating only organic food, exercising regularly, excelling in the gym, and you know, we're still prone to aging, sickness and death. I mean, it's good to do all these things, by the way. It's not that it's a waste of time. It's good to take care of the body. And sickness and aging are not emotionally neutral. It's an ongoing lesson in loss, and I think how much impermanence in our life is an ongoing lesson in loss. Yet in resistance and in denial, we actually come into actually the third domain of dukkha. The second domain of dukkha, by the way, I mentioned the first, which is dukkha-dukkha. The second domain of dukkha is the unsatisfactoriness. The unsatisfactoriness of being bound or dependent upon a world which is constantly changing and unstable in its conditions. It's just a fact. It's not a judgment. And the third domain of dukkha, of course, is what is called sankhata-dukkha. And this is where we heap emotional and psychological pain upon the pain of pain. Where we heap psychological and emotional pain upon the pain of pain. And we do that through resistance, we do it through denial, we do it through this shouldn't be happening. We heap suffering upon suffering. And I think in this there often feels no way out except to dissociate and to disconnect. And the habit patterns that we learn so easily and so well, I think, within the realm of the body, is that the habit patterns of judgment, fear, and resistance that are formed in relationship to the body become the habit patterns that are directed towards anything in life that we fear or resist. So we develop an expertise in sankhata dukkha. And learning within the body, this is something we actually can undo. We can learn to undo those habit patterns of heaping pain upon pain by aligning ourselves with how things actually are. And it's good to check this out for ourselves. You know, the patterns we establish in relationship to what we don't like or don't want in the body, are they any different than the habit patterns we establish in relationship to the sound we can't welcome, the difficult emotion we judge, the difficult person in our life, the neighbor we'd like to have move away, you know, the changes that we can't embrace? Are the habit patterns any different? So I think that's a good time to, well, first pause for a few minutes and then to sit for a few minutes before we break for lunch. Are there any reflections, any questions? Up. I hope there are some. Because, yes. I hope so. But if I don't, you need to remind me. I mean, it is a very good question, you know. What does it mean? What would it look like in our lives to align our lives, to align our speech, our thinking, our actions, our choices with that simple truth of impermanence? What would change for us? Would we do anything differently?
When you talk about aligning ourselves with how things are, I find sometimes there's a bit of a juggling trick with that.
A what?
A juggling trick.
Uh-huh.
Let's say it's something I don't want to be as it is. It is as it is, but I want to do something about it. And so there's this tension between doing something about it and accepting it as it is. And it's as though I'm not really accepting. Aligning myself with how things are, I'm still finding it. Because that's the society we live in, where we can do things.
Yes.
About things you don't want to do.
Well, I mean, I think that there's two different domains of this, I would say. You know, I mean, first of all, impermanence is not a value judgment. It's not good or bad. It's not any kind of value assessment. It's not an ethical judgment. It's a simple acknowledgement that all things that arise will pass, all things that have beginnings will end, all things that are born will fade. So that's this very simple teaching around the actuality of this universal law that runs through everything, okay? And I think what you're talking about is getting more into an ethical assessment or a reactive assessment. So, and I think that's a slightly different domain of, it's where we're getting more into a realm of something different, okay? Something more complex that does ask for investigation, okay? So, you know, I do sometimes, you know, sometimes I don't like the way things are and I want it to be different and I get into an agitated reactiveness to it, you know. I don't like the weather, you know, I'm moving to Florida, you know, I mean, I don't like this person, you know, I'm going to avoid them, you know, I don't like feeling this way, you know, I'm going to do what I can to numb that out. So that's one level of reactivity to the way things are, where we just kind of embrace it for very different reasons, but it's an activity of agitation and reactivity. And that's why I see it very important not to hear the way things are as a statement of ideology. Because the moment we hear it as a statement of ideology rather than an actuality that we're asked to embrace, there's another area of this which is actually ethical. You know, that thing, you know, being accepting does not mean that everything is acceptable. You know, that healing and liberating is more than an individual pursuit. It's a question of widening the circle of our concern, you know, for the people around us, for the people we don't know, for our planet, for our world. So acceptance is actually seeing the way things are in that moment of divided, fragmented, conflicted. But it's not an implication that everything is acceptable, you know, but the actual seeing things how they are, it's actually a kind of a first step towards wise response. You know, so when we move out of the simple actuality of change being an innate process, we're moving into a realm which is more complex, which is either a reactive realm, I think, or an ethical realm, which are actually two different realms, which asks us to decipher our relationship to how things actually are in this moment. Does that answer your question?
Very much so, yeah.
Okay, thank you. Yeah.
So I wanted to ask, with aging and illness, beyond the learnings, very fertile learnings around loss and impermanence, it seems like, and maybe it's only people I know, but there's almost a competition or piling on of when you get
There is no doubt that aging seems to include more collective contemplations of the body and the narratives of those collective contemplations. And I think for many people, it's not the competition always. I think there's a certain comfort in actually being able to talk about that story of the body being ill, the body suffering. It is very, very helpful to actually begin to see, you know, because this is part, I think, of the process of being so identified with the body as self. It's a kind of incremental creep, you know. At first I've got kind of, you know, I have some mindfulness around what's going on, and then you start to feel the mind start to contract about it. You become hypervigilant around it. The story starts to repeat and to repeat and to repeat. And this is a time when, you know, clearly there's some imbalance within the field of our attention. And you know, certainly I find this when I'm teaching with people who, say, live with chronic illness or chronic pain. I mean, you can't ignore it, you know, and you can't get into thinking that, you know, or trying to make this go away, and it's not possible to numb out from it. But it is possible to find some contrasting experience within the very same body. You know, like I've noticed that my earlobes are never distressed. You know, and when the body is ill, of course, it shouts at us. You know, the pain, the illnesses shout. The places that are well in our bodies have very quiet voices. But there is something about learning to bring those quiet voices also into the field of our attention to counter that tendency to become contracted, to become identified. And I think it's that tendency that to become contracted and identified that makes this kind of, you know, shared, collective, ongoing conversation about what's gone wrong now. I mean, you start to be a little careful with that question of how are you? And there is a need to actually balance the field, widen the field of attention. You know, what's well for you? And I think this is wonderful, and I think it's beautiful, and I think it's something to be quite careful around, you know, because I think in the Dharma world, you know, we feel an obligation to find the blessings in pain, and sometimes pain just hurts, and that's okay. You know, and I remember not long ago someone who'd lost their child, you know, and very much involved in practice for a long time, mistaking their grief for being that dukkha, whereas actually grief was the dukkha, you know. I mean, mistaking grief for being that sankhata dukkha, you know, the reaction to pain, whereas actually the grief was the pain, it wasn't a reaction to pain. And, you know, I'm a little bit mindful about always being careful to say to someone, now, what are you learning from the pain when someone is really in the midst of it? You know, so, and I'm just a little bit careful of that, that it can even be a dissociating mechanism, you know, rather than feeling and embracing what is going on with whatever capacity we have. We've got this background voice that says, I should be learning something from this. You know? And we no doubt will, but that is not the moment always.